Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording from our studio at the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Iraqi Chaldean Americans are reeling from news that the head of the Chaldean Church in Iraq has ordered 9 priests from the diocese in our region to return to Iraq, including Father Noel at St. Peter's Cathedral here in El Cajon. Critics say this amounts to a death sentence since ISIL terrorists are killing priests over there. Hear our interview today with Mark Arabo about the latest efforts to save Father Noel and other priests, including an appeal to Pope Francis. We'll tell you about the latest awards picked up by East County Magazine's talented team from the San Diego Press Club. You'll also hear about yellow fever mosquitoes found in our region for the first time ever and how to protect yourselves. We'll have information on a water bond measure on Tuesday's ballot and about a child molester proposed for release in Borrego Springs. An important race that's neck and neck in the polls is the California Superintendent of Public Education. The race pits the incumbent, a former teacher backed by teachers' unions, against a reformer backed by supporters of charter schools and privatizing public education. A hot race in East County is the Grossmont Union High School District Board. Just in time for Halloween, the Sequan tribe sent out mailers backing Barbara Stevens and Shirley Anderson with a message stating that incumbents Jim Kelly and Robert Shield have a scary record. Kelly and Shield ired the tribe and many other East County residents by failing to build an Alpine High School despite 2 bond measures that included funding for that purpose. The board has also defied a grand jury recommendation over the issue. Today you'll hear our interview with one of the challengers seeking a seat on that Grossmont board, Barbara Stevens. We'll tell you why crime is down in San Diego County despite prisoner releases under the statewide realignment program. And you'll hear about a new hotline for whistleblowers to report abuse of farm animals in California. So stay tuned for all of these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today, my very special guest is Mark Arabo. Many of you know him from the Neighborhood Market Association, but he is also a national spokesman for the Iraqi Chaldeans. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today, we're going to be talking about a very serious topic. Patriarch Sacco, the head of the Chaldean Church in Iraq, has ordered all 10 of the Iraqi priests, the Chaldean priests here in America who came over here from Iraq, to return to a very, very dangerous situation over there. And that includes Father Noel of St. Peter's Chaldean Church right here in El Cajon. Back on October 22nd, he had ordered that any of them who had not returned by that date would be essentially removed from the priesthood, I understand, Mark. Now, what is the latest that's happened since then?
Sure. Well, Bishop Serhat Jumu, the bishop of the Chaldean Catholic Church of the Western United States, made an appeal to Pope Francis because, as you know, Chaldeans are Catholics, and our
right.
Holy Father is Pope Francis. Patriarch Sacco is the head of the Chaldean Catholic Church, and extremely significant figure in not just our history, but our time in Iraq. And I think he has very well intentions.
Mm-hmm.
But, as anyone sometimes may make a mistake, this may be one of them. Because if we would deport 10 of our priests, which 9 of them are from this diocese, San Diego, half of our churches would be closed.
Wow. So there'd be nobody to minister to the
tens 70,000 faithful. And that's why Bishop Jumu appealed to Pope Francis for the Pope to ultimately rule if these priests should go back. One thing a lot of priests did say is that when Iraq is safe, they would return.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, right now, Mass is far and few
Right, ISIS has been, the ISIS terrorists over there have been beheading priests. We've heard these horrible stories about them using their heads as footballs and awful, awful things. Are there any priests left, any masses being conducted at all anywhere in Iraq right now, Mark?
We're at a very low capacity as far as masses. We know that, based on Father Noel and other folks have said, if he were to go back, he would get killed.
Yeah.
And it would be basically committing suicide. So one thing we've asked for is for when Iraq becomes more safe, then they could reconsider. But for now, sending a priest, our priest, that have been here since 1990, who is an American citizen, back into the hands of a war zone and the potential hands of ISIS, would be sentencing his life.
Yeah, basically
to death.
Martyrdom. They're asking these priests to be martyrs.
Yeah. And I think Patriarch Sako means well. You know, he is, we pray for him every single day. And we hope that Iraq one day will return to a place for everyone, inclusivity.
Yeah.
But to ship 10 priests out there would be a complete disaster to the faithful, to the 10 priests, and they don't want to go. They've said that if we go back, we will get killed, and we cannot let our priests.
So what happens if they just don't go? Are they?
So right now, Pope Francis is, decide. We're very confident and optimistic that Pope Francis, the angel of humanity that he is, our Holy Father, will let the priest stay in America. And we have received confirmation from the Vatican that they received the appeal and that they're studying it, and the Pope will make a ruling in the near future.
Now, does the application of an appeal mean that the decision is on hold, basically, that they don't have to go back to Iraq until until the Pope renders his decision?
Exactly. Since Bishop Jomo has appealed to Pope Francis, canon law states that the suspension from the patriarch in itself has been suspended, and those 10 priests are able to facilitate all their faculties, and they're able to be priests and serve the faithful and spread the good word.
Very good. Do you have any idea of how long a timetable it might be until the Pope makes a decision one way or the other on this?
We don't know a timetable. We know that the Vatican is looking into it, and Pope Francis should be making his decision. But as far as a timetable, we don't know of when.
Well, we're certainly all hoping for the sake of these priests and their lives that you know, the decision will be a humane one.
Yeah.
If the decision is not what you're hoping for, do you have any idea what the priests will do, or for that matter, what the church will do? Is this something that could cause a rift in the church itself, such as we've seen with, you know, Martin Luther or the Church of England breaking away from the Catholic Church?
You know, there's been a scholar, I believe, from UC Berkeley that wrote a great paper on that this may talk about an undertone between a tug-of-war between Pope Francis and the Patriarch with the Vatican and the Patriarch's decision. And I'll email it to you because there's folks that are a lot more well-informed about that situation than myself. I do know, though, that we are in full communion with Rome. Pope Francis is our Holy Father, and ultimately it is him that will decide the fate of the Chaldean Catholics around the world. And right now the people in San Diego, the 70,000 faithful, our bishop, Bishop Jomo, and the 10 priests have said, we need the priests to stay to serve the faithful, to spread the good word. We cannot send these priests like cattle to a slaughter. They're not sacrificial lambs. They're priests.
We were talking in the lobby about some historical precedents for this involving the Jews in Europe. Can you elaborate a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, as you recall, in the 90s in Russia, when they were trying to get rid of the Jewish community, they said, well, the Jewish community will lose its roots in Russia. So a million left to America, a million went to Israel, and a million stayed. And through Chabad, the Jewish community worldwide built Russia from the outside. And so we've seen in history when there's places in the world that are having turmoil for a certain community, there's always folks that say, let's stay here. The problem with that is this. If you're sitting inside of a burning home, you can't rebuild. You have to get out of the house, let the remains, let it burn. And then when it's thus settled, you rebuild your house. You rebuild your land from the outside in, and you go back.
So you're saying that someday, when it's safe in Iraq from the terrorism, that some of these priests would be willing to go back and help to rebuild the church there, but not when it's meaningless, not when they could simply go back to be massacred and not accomplish any good out of that.
Absolutely. And we will never write off Iraq. We still believe in an inclusive Iraq for everyone, with Shiites, Kurds, Sunnis, and Christians. But you have to build it from the outside in. And we also saw this in the Holocaust. In the Holocaust, a lot of rabbis told folks, you can't leave Germany, you'll lose your roots. That wasn't the case.
Yeah,
the folks that stayed were killed.
That's right.
And we have to learn from history. We have to think about humanity and make humane decisions. And nobody wins when you send a priest back into a war zone. The focus should be making sure the folks that want safe passage could get out. The folks that want to stay, give them protection. The folks that want to make sure they survive, give them the humanitarian aid.
On that note, I would like to ask you for an update on your efforts that we've talked about before on the show to help get safe passage out of Iraq for the, what is it, more than 1 million people now that are seeking safe passage out of there because of the persecution by ISIS against the Christians and other minorities.
So we have around 400,000 Christians left in Iraq right now. There's 1.4 million in 2003, a million have already left. The remaining 400,000, around 80,000 have reached out to us, given their names, filled out the forms, and said, please advocate for us to leave. So we're letting the people decide what's best for themselves and for their families. Right now, we've been able to secure a total of 53,000 visas. 20,000 are abroad, 5,000 in Australia, 5,000 in Sweden, 5,000 in France, 5,000 in Canada, and 33,000 in America. One challenge right now is getting the State Department to go back to Iraq to start processing.
Yes.
And so what we're working on is tomorrow I'm actually meeting with Vice President Joe Biden. He'll be in San Diego.
Very good. I should mention we're taping this on Friday. It'll be airing on Monday. So you're meeting with the Vice President. And what is your
hope
to come out of that? Yeah.
And it'll be my second meeting in the last 3 weeks. And my hope is to get him to listen to the ambassador in Iraq, the American ambassador, that has said it's okay to send the State Department folks back. And let's start processing these folks. For the folks that want to leave, let's allow them safe passage. For those who want to stay, let's give them protection as best as we could.
Now, last night was the Chaldean American Association banquet, and I spoke briefly with Congressman Juan Vargas, who was there.
Yeah.
He, of course, has introduced the bill that would lift the immigration cap on the Chaldeans and other persecuted minorities in Iraq to allow more of them to come into the United States, but Congress adjourned without taking action on that, as they did with many other things, including whether there should be a war declaration in the Middle East and other things. But he did say he's very determined to try to continue to push forward with that whenever Congress reconvenes, and also that he was very disappointed that, you know, it might be too late to save some people over there. What more can you tell us about that effort?
Congressman Juan Vargas is a tremendous champion for humanity. I told him last night, and I really believe it, there's a special place in heaven for that man because of the lives he's going to save and that he's trying to save. He is the congressman that I first worked with back in June of this year when I first went to D.C. and when I was on your program, when we announced this effort to save these people's lives.
Does the entire San Diego congressional delegation support it? I know Susan Davis was there last night. She certainly does. Who else?
So all the delegates on board are on board. Congressman Duncan Hunter is great. I was on one of UT editorial question board Wednesday on the USS Midway with him. He's a patriot and he's on board. Susan Davis is on board. Juan Vargas, of course, is the author.
Scott Peters and Daryl Issa?
Scott Peters is on board, and we heard also Daryl Issa. So we were able to get the local delegates. We're working with the U.S. Senate to get a Senate bill. But we're also working with the president and the vice president to see what can the State Department do now.
Yeah.
There's laws on the books right now. where this president could fix a lot of tragedies in Iraq and save a lot of people's lives. And, you know, I said it in June of 2014, as I'll say today, that I've never been more optimistic, never been more hopeful. We are seeing this through the end, and this is a marathon, and I will not stop. We will not stop until we save as many lives as we can.
What about other countries? Are any of them taking in some of these refugees?
We know that France has taken in some families. We know that Canada is also working on that, and Australia and Sweden. But we need to not forget about our brothers and sisters in Iraq. We need to let the world know that this is a Christian genocide before our eyes, that Yazidis and Christians need to be saved and rescued. And for the sake of humanity, offer them a home, and for those who want to stay, offer them protection.
How effective are the U.S. airstrikes and the other military actions that we're seeing over there, Mark? Is it helping to stem the violence of ISIS at all, or is this continuing to spread despite all of that?
You know, all the reports we've seen and talks with the State Department have been really to the effect that the airstrikes are somewhat effective in the sense that they're better than nothing. They're offering containment.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have a group like ISIS and the Sunni tribes taking one-third of the country and have made and making $3 million a day on selling oil on the black market through neighboring countries, they have force and they have money.
What is the answer ultimately? How should the ISIS crisis be addressed? What will it take realistically to not just contain but stop this, or can it be?
We need a stronger foreign policy. We need a strategy that is all-inclusive.
Are you talking boots on the ground?
There should be, I think, international boots on the ground. It should be an international coalition. Neighboring countries need to step up because they have the most to lose. Iran needs to step up. They have a lot to lose. America's role always is the leader of any good effort. And we've seen that when America leads, other nations follow. But right now, America isn't leading as much as it could or as much as it should. Short term, an easy decision is to save the lives that are being targeted and killed. Give a home for these Christians and Yazidis.
I'd like to talk about one other thing, and that is on a more positive note, that locally, fundraising efforts here to help those who have been displaced by ISIS have actually been very successful. I understand that over $615,000 was raised by the event that was right here in El Cajon last month to assist the Iraqi Christians. Can you give us a little bit of an update? I know at the dinner last night they said that 300,000 of that had been distributed to Iraq, where the bishop has been arranging housing for the Iraqi refugee families. Another 200,000 went to help refugees in Turkey, and the rest was helping some who fled to Lebanon. If people want to help further with that effort, Mark, how can they do that?
Sure. First, I want to thank the owners of A1 Storage. They've been phenomenal.
They made an enormous donation.
Of $250,000.
Wow. $250,000 by this locally owned company?
Locally owned.
Wow.
Really humanitarians, philanthropists.
Yeah.
That really are angels. Yesterday was a great event. The Cali American Association did a phenomenal job for their dinner banquet. Mm-hmm. Nuri Barca and Hani Damia did a great job. And I believe Mr. Alzwaf from the Knights of Columbus showed exactly where the money went, and we really are thankful for those who want to give. And if people want to reach down and help and support to save lives, they could visit our website at endthegenocide.com.
Endthegenocide.com. And that's where they can make donations if they want to help the displaced refugees?
They could go there, and they could also, if they wanted to, the Iraqi Christian Relief Fund through St. Peter Diocese. So there's multiple ways people could help. It depends on different ways.
Very good.
Either or.
And we should also remind those who may not be familiar with the history of the Chaldeans that these are, some would say, the original Christians. It's part of the world that dates back, the cradle of civilization,
right.
ancient Mesopotamia. The yeah. Chaldeans are the descendants of ancient Babylon, mm-hmm. and some of the churches being destroyed by ISIS date back to the first century
yep.
AD. So it's quite a phenomenal situation. Mark, I'm going to let you have the closing words here. What final thoughts would you like to leave our listeners with today?
You know, I really want to thank your radio station because you guys were one of the first stations that we came on and we talked
yeah.
about.
Mm-hmm.
I want to thank the San Diego community at large. I want to thank everyday Americans that have really raised their voices with ours. They joined our Facebook and our Twitter with their tweets, with their likes.
Mm-hmm.
They have moved this journey forward. We are not stopping. We are not giving up. But it's because all of us are united together for humanity and for life and for really opening up our doors and our hearts and our minds to the victims of genocide. And I'm asking every single person to call Congressman Goodlett to say pass House Bill 5430. We have a bill in the House. We will reintroduce it next year if it doesn't pass the remaining of this year. I'm going back to Washington, D.C. in a couple weeks. And we're not going to stop. We're seeing this to the end. And ultimately, I ask everyone to pray for us.
Yeah.
And I know that so many things to pray for. And
whatever your faith, whatever your denomination.
Whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever you pray to. And I hope that everyone comes together, the Jewish community, the Muslim community, the Christian community, the Buddhist community. We're all together, united as for humanity, human beings that want peace and love and happiness.
Yeah, we should all stand against genocide and just
right.
the senseless brutality that we're seeing over there in the Middle
yeah.
East right now. So, Mark, I want to thank you so very much
sure.
for joining us here once again today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
Thank you.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, networking for social justice.
East County Magazine picked up 11 more awards in San Diego Press Club's 2014 Excellence in Journalism Awards on October 28th, bringing our total to 80 journalism awards since our launch in 2008. This year's awards include winners in the following categories: Breaking News, Environment, General News, Investigative Reporting, Political and Government, Public Service and Consumer Advocacy, Criminal Justice, Health and Medicine, Radio Special Reporting, and Radio Feature Categories. East County Magazine editor and radio show producer Miriam Raftery said she is pleased at this recognition from San Diego Press Club for our dedicated team of reporters, photographers, and broadcast journalists. Our team includes interns, citizen volunteers, and media professionals who have all worked hard to provide news in the public interest. Out of the Ashes, our special radio report on the 10th anniversary of the Cedar Fire, which aired on KNSJ and was produced by Miriam Raftery, received a first place award for specialty reporting. This special report had previously also won first place in the Society of Professional Journalists competition. Leon Thompson received a first place Integrated Media Award in the Health and Medicine category for his report, A Hearty Recovery, documenting his own recovery from open-heart surgery on our radio show and news website. Our intern, Jessica Richmond, received a first place award for environmental reporting in the Daily Newspapers and Websites category for her article titled, An Ecological Disaster in the Making, examining the history and impacts of major energy products here in East County. She also shared a third place award with editor Miriam Raftery in the criminal justice category for a story titled, Sheriff Response Times in Rural Areas Raise Concerns. Tom and Nadine Abbott's coverage of the Chariot Fire on Mount Laguna earned a third place award for breaking news with a story titled, Historic Lodge at Shrine Camp, Sierra Club's Foster Lodge Cabin Among 108 Buildings Destroyed in Chariot Fire. Nadine Abbott also took a second place award in the general news category for her story, Six States Ballot Initiative Effort Seeks to Split California. East County Magazine editor Miriam Raftery won several awards, including several shared with other staff members. In addition to those already mentioned, Raftery won second place for environmental reporting with a story titled, Soytech Fails to Disclose Truth About Impacts of Solar Projects. She picked up another second place award for public service and consumer advocacy for a story titled, Why is County Veteran Services Ignoring Rural East County Vets? That story resulted in passage of a measure by county supervisors to bring veteran services to rural libraries. Raftery won a third place investigative reporting award for her article titled, Was It Fraud? Experts Raise Serious Questions After Low First-Year Energy Production at Ocotillo Wind. In addition, she took third place in the political and government category for her coverage of events that led to the resignation of El Cajon's mayor, with an article titled, Mayor Lewis in Controversy Over Comments on Chaldeans. And last but not least, Mark and Cody Clement shared a third place radio feature award for their entertaining Wildest Jobs interview with a rodeo clown in Lakeside, which aired here on East County Magazine's radio show on KNSJ. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, this is Ed Barrena.
This is Miriam Raftery with a health report. For the first time, a new invasive mosquito that carries yellow fever has been found in San Diego County. These mosquitoes feed in daylight hours, unlike local mosquitoes, and can transmit several tropical diseases. Military entomologists at Naval Base San Diego discovered four Aedes aegypti mosquitoes, otherwise known as yellow fever mosquitoes, in the last couple of weeks in offices at the base on San Diego Bay. Navy and county vector control teams are putting traps on and around the base to learn if there are more of these mosquitoes, which have also recently been found in Los Angeles County. The mosquito is small and black with white stripes. It differs from native California mosquitoes by being an aggressive pest. Residents are urged to report to the county if mosquitoes are biting in the daytime. The yellow fever mosquito has commonly been found on the East Coast and other places. However, it started showing up in a few California counties in 2013. Officials want to keep it out of our state because it can spread dangerous diseases including yellow fever, chikungunya, and dengue fever, which are currently rare here. Yellow fever, once known as yellow jack and yellow plague, is largely contained to tropical areas of Africa and Latin America nowadays, and there has not been an outbreak in the United States in over 100 years, though it was once a deadly scourge in the American South and in New York. Without treatment, it can kill 50% of those who contract it, causing organ damage, although there is a vaccine that's available in areas where yellow fever is prevalent. Chikungunya is a viral disease that has historically been kept to Africa, Asia, Europe, and other areas. However, it's been spreading in recent years. This year, two travelers brought it home to San Diego County, and in Florida, over 100 cases have been reported, including the first two ever acquired in the United States. Chikungunya symptoms include fever and severe joint pain, often in the hands and feet, and can include headache, muscle pain, joint swelling, and a rash. It's rarely fatal, but there is no vaccine or medication for it. Dengue fever is also still rare, but has been seen here on a yearly basis. San Diego County Department of Health and Human Services statistics report that a dozen people in San Diego got sick from dengue fever in the last 2 years after they contracted it while visiting other countries. Dengue disease and the more severe dengue hemorrhagic fever are caused by viruses carried by the yellow fever mosquito. Dengue hemorrhagic fever can be fatal, and there is no vaccine or cure. Symptoms include sudden onset of fever, headache, pain behind the eyes, joint pain, muscle and bone pain, rash, and bleeding. Prevent mosquito breeding by getting rid of items that can hold standing water, such as plant saucers, toys, and old tires, and dumping out rain gutters. You can get free mosquito fish from the county that will eat mosquitoes in swimming pools, ponds, fountains, and horse troughs. Protect yourself by wearing long sleeves and pants when outdoors. Use insect repellent containing DEET or other appropriate ingredients when outside. Make sure screens on windows and doors are in good condition and secured to keep the insects out. County environmental health officials urge the public to eliminate and report any standing water that could be breeding grounds for these mosquitoes, not only outdoors but also inside homes, because these mosquitoes can actually breed indoors. Report green swimming pools or other standing water sources to the County Vector Control Program at 858-694-2888 or email vector@sdcounty.ca.gov. You can also anonymously report neglected pools by downloading the county's Fight the Bite app for your phone.
California's water woes are one of the issues on Election Day. Voters will decide on Proposition 1, known as the Water Bond, which sets aside billions to update water infrastructure, recycle water, and improve conservation. Steve Rothert at American Rivers says it's been decades since the state made significant investments in water systems, both natural and man-made. And whether it's rivers and wetlands or a dam, he says they are in great need of help.
Not only to address the current and future droughts, but also to restore the fisheries and ecosystems that are the backbone of California's natural history.
Total funding is slightly more than $7 billion. Projects include watershed protection, increasing stream flows, and cleaning up groundwater contamination. The bond contains funding for water storage projects, and that's where there's been the most intense debate, as Rothert explains.
There is controversy because it includes $2.7 billion for water storage, but many people don't understand that that doesn't necessarily mean dams.
He says groundwater storage will be the focus, which is much less expensive to establish, improve, and maintain than building new dams. Also, the water bond specifically states that any funding for surface storage projects will have to be approved by the California Water Commission in consultation with the State Water Board and Department of Fish and Wildlife. Any funding allocated to water supply projects must be cost-effective and provide a net improvement in ecosystem and water quality conditions. For Public News Service, I'm Deborah Smith.
The state is proposing to release convicted child molester Gary Snavely, a sexually violent predator in Borrego Springs. Snavely was convicted of molesting two girls ages 8 and 9 in Orange County back in 1987. In 1996, he was convicted of failing to register as a sex offender in San Diego County and went back to prison. After his release, he was placed in Hacumba in 2008, but after he abused his psychotropic medication and lied to his supervising staff, he went back to Coalinga State Hospital, though he was not accused of committing new crimes. The Department of State Hospitals proposes that Gary Snavely live on Club Circle East near the Borrego Springs Country Club. He could be required to wear a GPS monitor. However, a GPS monitor did not stop a predator released in Hacumba recently from entering a nearby home and sexually assaulting a woman there. Supervisor Bill Horn calls Snavely the worst of the worst, adding, quote, "No child or family should be forced to live in fear with Snavely as their neighbor," unquote. Another sexual predator, Terry Stone, was released into Borrego Springs earlier this year. Stone had molested five young boys in San Diego County back in the 1980s and early 90s. A hearing on Gary Snavely's proposed release will be held on December 5th at 9 a.m. in San Diego Superior Court, where the public can provide comments. You can also submit comments in writing through November 10th by emailing sdsafe@sdsheriff.org or calling 858-495-3619. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barena.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. One of the closest education contests statewide is shaping up in the California Superintendent of Education race. The race pits incumbent Tom Torlakson, a former teacher who is backed by the American Federation of Teachers and California Teachers Association, against Marshall Tuck, a charter school administrator, Harvard Business School graduate, and former Wall Street banker, who wants to weaken teacher tenure protections and support school vouchers, among other what he calls reforms. A field poll shows the two candidates in a virtual dead heat. Torlakson states, "My opponent is bankrolled by people who want to cut education funding, shut down public pensions, and privatize our public schools." Tuck's funders include Carrie Walton Penner, daughter of Walmart's chairman, who previously spent large sums in an effort to defeat Prop 30, a measure that provided more money to public schools in California. Torlakson, by contrast, supported Prop 30. He also worked to boost funds to school districts to implement new Common Core standards and fund programs for new career and college readiness programs. Tuck claims reforms are needed because California schools have ranked low nationally on test scores for math and reading for a number of years. He claims to have turned around low-performing schools for needy kids in Los Angeles. But a study by UC Berkeley found a 50% turnaround rate among charter middle school and high school teachers, and that includes high turnover rates in Green Dot charter schools that were overseen by Tuck. A Los Angeles Times article reported that 2 years into Tuck's leadership in L.A., low-performing schools at other Los Angeles unified schools had greater achievements, actually, in gains than the schools under Tuck's charters, despite more money spent at the schools that Tuck oversaw. Out of 16 schools that Tuck was in charge of as CEO of the Partnership for Los Angeles Schools, 15 of those 16 posted English language arts scores below the state average in the 2012-13 school year, and 11 of the 16 failed to meet the state average for math. Tuck contends we need major changes in public education, and in a system with 6 million students, change can't happen overnight. But Torlakson points to improvements on his watch as California's superintendent of schools, including an increase in high school graduation rates to an all-time high of 80%, as well as increases in eighth grade reading levels and improved funding for public education statewide. Torlakson concludes, this is not the time to put progress at risk. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording in our studio in the East County Wellness Center here in El Cajon. My very special guest today is Barbara Stevens, who is one of the candidates vying for 3 seats on the Grossmont Union High School District Board. So what we have in this district is we have 6 candidates running for 3 seats. 2 of the seats are held by incumbents, Jim Kelly and Robert Shields. The third one is open because Trustee Dick Hoy has announced his resignation. And there's some interesting other folks running, one of whom is Dr. Gary Woods, who actually was voted off the board before, who voted consistently in a block with Mr. Kelly and Mr. Shields. And so voters voted him off, and now he's running to regain the seat. Welcome to the show, Barbara.
Thank you, Miriam. It's nice to be here.
Now, I understand that you have an interesting background. You have a daughter who attended the district.
Yes, I have a daughter who graduated from Helix Charter High School and then on from Cal State San Marcos as a softball athlete on a scholarship.
Well, congratulations to her. As a parent, I understand that you spent quite a few hours actually attending the Grossmont District Board meetings. What was your general perception and what made you decide that you wanted to step forward and run for the board?
Well, there are a number of things that made me want to run for the board. You can also watch the board meetings online. The district posts them on their website. But the ones I've attended and most of the online ones, you can tell there's a distinct tension between some of the members where it almost appears that blocking action or interests is more important than really moving the whole district forward. And I hope to change that.
What are some of the areas where you saw a lot of contention, where you believe that you would have a different approach?
It appears one member would want to put something on the agenda to be discussed, and either it somehow doesn't get there or it's pretty much pushed off by the members.
What are some of the issues that have come before this board that were contentious, where in your point of view, there might have been a better way to handle it?
Well, one issue that really got me angry was extending the contract for the program management piece of the bond construction projects without going out to competition after the 5-year period.
Yeah, now I understand that you have actually had an attorney send a letter at one point saying, why is this not going out for open bid? You know, this is something that many other districts bid out. What response did you get from that?
I basically got a response that said that they thought they were getting a good value. They felt it would be disruptive to put this contract up for a rebid, and they're contractor promised that they would be getting a small reduction. I think they mentioned something like 6% in some areas. That was now 3 years ago, and so they've extended that contract each year without going out for competition since then, and they just extended it this year again.
Yeah, that's a lot of money going out the door. So you have indicated that you've had information that GAFCON, the program management company that's had these tremendously lucrative bids to build everything from swimming pools to theaters, all the bond projects, money projects, GAFCON has perhaps greased the wheels a little bit by donating to favorite charities. And how does that work exactly?
Well, they can get in more trouble giving direct donations. People can pick that up pretty easily. But there's nothing wrong about them giving, say, to a board member's favorite charity and asking other contractors on the job to do so. And I think you can you know, if you dig around a little bit, you can kind of follow those patterns. And maybe the board member helps and maybe they don't, but it's not a good perception when you think that they're influencing things that way.
Yeah, there you go. And certainly the amount of money that's gone out to this contractor is a lot of money at a time when the district has been saying, we can't afford to build a high school in Alpine, for example. Do you believe that maybe if they'd bid this out and gotten a competitive bid, that they might have been able to save enough money to do some of these things that people in the district have wanted to see done?
I think they certainly would have saved some money. And to get a performance audit, which is what some of the activists, some of the people who've been watching these expenditures have been asking for, a serious forensic or performance audit, and they've been pushed off, and their concerns have not been
paid attention
observed.
To. Yeah,
but
that sounds very similar to what's happened with the Citizens Bond Oversight Committee, where they had Nick Marinovich, who was very outspoken and saying they're not doing what a bond oversight committee should do, and that the board was basically controlling the bond oversight committee. And Mr. Marinovich, he's the guy that was in charge of the Sweetwater Union District, High School Union District Bond Oversight Committee, where people actually got indicted, you know, under his watchdog leadership. So that's a pretty serious thing. And then he wound up actually stepping down because he felt pressured, and he said this board wasn't listening to him. What are your feelings about the handling of the Citizens Bond Oversight situation?
I think that Mr. Marinovich was unfortunately not listened to. I don't think they used him very well. He's got a great background in finding out where there's been wrongdoings in financial matters. And they quickly marginalized him and didn't really listen to him. And when he tried to bring topics up to be discussed in the CBOC, it was pushed aside or forgotten to be put on the agenda. So there was a series of events that happened that caused him to step down, which I don't blame him. I mean, he was obviously not being listened to.
One of the most contentious issues in this district has long been the Alpine High School. Listeners who may not be familiar with this, the citizens of Alpine, of the entire district, in fact, twice voted for bond measures, Prop H and Prop U, that specifically called for the building of a 12th high school in Alpine, and yet they consistently found reasons not to do it. They claimed that they hadn't met certain thresholds, and other people said that they had. But the upshot of it was this ultimately led to a grand jury investigation, and the grand jury found that, in fact, they hadn't done right by the people of Alpine. When you have a grand jury report that says, fool me once, fool me twice, that gives you a clue what the grand jury thought. The grand jury came back and said, by year's end, last year, we want you to either put forth a firm construction timetable to build the high school, or get out of the way, support unification with the Alpine Union District up there. Currently not a high school district, it goes up through middle school, so that they can build the high school, turn over the money and let them do it. So basically, the build it or get out of the way. And in fact, at year's end, the board did neither. They did not come up with a construction timetable, still say they're not going to build it, and furthermore, that they actually voted to oppose the unification, with the exception of Priscilla Schreiber, Trustee Schreiber, who voted the other way. So what is your position about the Alpine High School situation? Do you support what the board has done, or what would you do about this if you were to get elected?
Well, I certainly can't support what the board has done officially. You know, it's awkward with Priscilla Schreiber being in the middle of it saying the board. I know she's probably getting angry being
I do need to clarify that. Well, we've said the board all along, really. Priscilla has been a voice of dissent on most of the most controversial issues, I think.
To look at what's happened with Prop H, my understanding of what happened was basically there was a serious underestimation of what it would really cost to build a brand new school. And the board recognized that, went back to the Alpine group that had worked with them on designing a school and working towards that goal, and said, hey, you know what, help us out here. If you hold off and not ask for your unification, which they had been working on even back then.
Yeah, many years ago. Mm-hmm.
And we'll write Prop U and get you your school. And the school was actually mentioned in Prop U.
Yes.
So that was what taxpayers voted for. Now, there was a clause in there that tied it to an enrollment trigger or something like that.
Which Doug Dean will tell you was met not once, but many times over. He chaired the Chamber's Education Committee, and he chaired the Boundary Commission study and some other things. And, you know, they, so I guess there's different interpretations of it, but...
But the fact remains there's enough students still up there that need to have a school so they don't have to make that drive. And we've got the property. We've got the permits that are still in effect right now to do some construction. And if the money's there, I say we should go ahead and start construction on a much scaled down version. The figure I've heard right now is there's maybe 800 students ready to attend a high school up there. And taking the plans that they had for the school and scaling them down and getting something started. And if they gain unification, then that's part of the package that they take. If they don't get unification, we're just a couple years closer to having a facility that students up in that area could use.
Yeah. And to be clear, that's a very different position than what the two incumbents trying to get reelected have. Mr. Shields and Mr. Kelly have both consistently voted against the Alpine High School pretty much every opportunity.
I get the feeling in many of these issues that there's a personal vindication going on. I know one of the issues that got a couple of members of the board angry was just what would we name the school?
I remember that. I remember that very distinctly.
And I just get the feeling on many of these issues that this anger builds up and becomes just a reason to block all progress.
Yeah, the background on that was that they wanted to name it Ronald Reagan High School, which actually violated their own district policy that schools are supposed to be named after geographic features. And actually, a lot of people in Alpine didn't want that, including, happened to be at the meeting on that issue where they had the naming committee or whatever they called it, and you actually had Viejas tribal leaders showing up saying, you know, Ronald Reagan wasn't so good to the Indians. He cut Indian health care and did a lot of other things and went to Europe and said Indians should become citizens, and they have been since 1940 or so. So they really didn't want their kids going to a school named for that particular individual, and they disbanded the whole naming committee after that and pretty well gave up on trying to build a high school. And yeah, I've heard that same rumor. I don't know if it's true, but
I'd say
I've heard that
the first
as well.
Thing I would say is, let the people who are going to a school figure out a name for it. I mean, I don't particularly care if it's named after a geographical location or something more significant for that area. That's certainly not a reason to stop building a school. I just can't believe that.
Exactly. Tell us a little bit about your background. We've mentioned about, you know, personalities and all these clashes between these board members. I don't think I've ever covered a more contentious board in my 30 years. I guess it becomes germane to ask, what is your background like, and what would you bring to the table in terms of any sort of conciliatory attitude on board?
I've always been a person that gets along with people pretty well, and I am able to bring people together a little bit more by just trying to be the middle ground and show where the other person's argument has some merits.
Your background is in communications, I understand. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I've, you know, San Diego State grad, but English major, art minor, yay, go Aztecs. But I've done a little bit of lobbying work. In the 80s, I was in Washington, D.C. doing informational lobbying, which isn't like influence peddling, but I would write position papers and advocate particular points of view and go in and sit with the staff at various congressional offices and deliver testimony in Congress. But it was more or less just getting people who thought that they were enemies to just sit down and either, you know, have lunch together or just discuss an issue outside of a political environment. And it's amazing what people will do if they will sit down and just talk to each other in an informal way.
Well, very interesting. So we might have some mediation on that board if you get in the door. There you go. Where can people get more information about you, Barbara, and about your campaign if they want to learn more?
Well, I've got a Facebook page that's Barbara Stevens for Grossmont Union High School District Board of Trustees. A little long, but it's there. So I've been putting some information up on that. Otherwise, they can contact me directly. I can give you my email, bsbarb aol.com.
Is there anything else, Barbara, that you would like our listeners to know about you, the board, or your candidacy?
Well, I'd like for people to know that I'm going to focus on really connecting with the community and the staff, teachers, and students, and parents of the district. I think they have all been kind of sitting in the back seat while a lot of these decisions have been made. They haven't felt like they've been part of a lot of the decision process. And I've started visiting each one of the campuses and trying to meet with the principals and some of the other groups associated with the different campuses. But I think we need to just start thinking about things in a different way. We're not going to get a lot of state money anymore. We're not going to get a whole bunch of federal money anymore. And we're going to have to be very creative and maybe just start asking, why don't we do it differently? And give a few things a try.
We've talked about some of the areas where you disagree with the board, but I would also like to know, are there some areas where you agree with the directions that this board has taken, some things that maybe they've done right where listeners might or voters might expect to see some continuity from you?
Well, first of all, I think we have a very great district. We've got some wonderful schools. We've got great students, teachers, and staff. We're all trying to do great things. I think they've done the best they can with getting the Common Core program implemented. I'm not sure how that's going to all stack out once it gets through, but that's at least we've got a start on that. You know, they're good people on the board. I just would like to see them quit fighting with each other and think of the students and community more than their personal interests.
Well, thank you very, very much for joining us here today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Thank you.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
When Assembly Bill 109 passed in 2011, the state turned responsibility for nonviolent criminals over to local counties. That meant prisoners were shifted from county prisons to local jails, and some were released early under mandatory supervision programs. Despite fears that this would increase crime, it turns out that the opposite has occurred. 3 years after the state's public safety realignment took effect, county public safety and health leaders are reporting positive outcomes. In fact, the rate of violent crimes and property crimes has actually fallen, the county now reports. The successful management of the thousands of felons under the county's realignment plan was credited to a collaborative effort focused on rehabilitation, crime analysis, and aggressive enforcement. Supervisor Diane Jacob, chair of the County Board of Supervisors, says all the statistics look good. Under realignment, about 240 criminals are sentenced each month, most for property and drug crimes. The Public Defender's Office encourages eligible felons to participate in collaborative programs aimed at treating each offender's issues, such as programs to help veterans or treat drug addiction. The Sheriff's Department estimates it now houses about 1,500 offenders who are serving multi-year sentences. Expanded jail capacity and rehabilitative programs inside jails have helped manage the increase in criminals sentenced locally. The Probation Department supervises about 2,200 felons under realignment when they are released from custody. About 400 of those are under mandatory supervision. Offenders are also referred into over 150 rehabilitative programs. In addition, the County Health and Human Services Agency provides drug and alcohol treatment programs and mental health treatment. Public safety officials are also holding offenders accountable with announcing visits and promptly arresting them if they reoffend. Lower crime rates are a key indicator of success, Sheriff Bill Gore told supervisors this week. So far this year, violent crime rates are down to 3.43 crimes per every 1,000 people, compared to a rate of 3.7 in 2012. The property crime rate this year is 19.4 crimes per 1,000, down from 22.2 per 1,000 last year, according to the San Diego Association of Governments. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
Whistleblowers in California could earn up to a $5,000 reward if their tip leads to the arrest and conviction of anyone involved in the abuse of farm animals. The Humane Society of the United States has just launched a national tip line where callers can report animal abuse at farms, slaughterhouses, or livestock auctions. Paul Shapiro with HSUS says as a result of their undercover investigations, they have found animal abuse at factory farms and slaughterhouses is rampant in the U.S.
Our exposés have found evidence of workers and management cruelly beating, kicking, dragging, even torturing animals. And this is the type of cruelty that simply has no place in our society and it needs to stop.
The tip line is the result of some states passing ag gag laws, such as Idaho, where it is now illegal to photograph farm animals being abused in a facility.
It's basically evidence of an industry that is grasping at straws, trying to keep Americans in the dark. You know that an industry has a lot to hide when they want to make it a crime to document the abuse of animals.
Shapiro says California is a leader when it comes to protection for farm animals, with many laws in place, such as a ban on foie gras and laws against tail docking of dairy cows and inhumane confinement of chickens, pigs, and calves. The tip line is especially for workers at farms and slaughterhouses, but anyone can call and report abuse and also remain anonymous if they choose. The Humane Society will investigate and verify all claims, and up to $5,000 will be paid if the tip leads to an arrest and conviction of those who have committed acts of cruelty against farm animals. The hotline number is 1-888-209-7177. For Public News Service, I'm Monique Coppola.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.